Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. in Central Europe. It's other times at other places because that is the nature of our circular globe of an Earth. Yes, it is a globe. We believe in round Earth here on the Writer's Block. It is a controversial take, but I am going to give it. And with me here tonight, I have Hvitgerd, the guardian of the White Yard, the warden of wisdom. Hvitgerd, how are you doing tonight?
I am full of Yuletide and Christmas cheer.
Yes, feeling I can tell it by your voice. I can tell it by the exuberance and enthusiasm of your voice, Hvitgerd. And good to have you in such good cheer.
Thank you. Likewise.
All right. And of course, we will be discussing Christmas lore. We will be discussing Yuletide lore, the traditions of Europeans people with regard to the end of the year celebrations, because, you know, whether you call it Christmas, whether you call it Yule, whether you call it all of the weird names that all of the weird peoples of Europe have for this celebration, it is universal. It is anchored to the ancient Indo-European calendar, the celebration of the winter solstice and the all of the associated natural phenomena with the deep winter, the isolation, the cold. So much of the cold has been imprinted on our psyche and on our evolutionary heritage that we cannot help but commemorate it in our spiritual observations and our worship of the calendar. But before we get into that, yes, you guessed it, people, we have some crass financial concerns to address. We are having a fundraiser here on Countercurrents. We are raising funds, and this week only, unless I'm very much mistaken, we have a $2,000 matching grant because we have one of our listeners offered to match every dollar raised up to $2,000. So if you donate a dollar, we get two. If you donate 100, we get 200. Up to $2,000, so total for a total of $4,000 going towards the Countercurrents fundraiser, which of course is still running and will be running towards the end of the year. It is the season of giving, so give. Give with those donations. We depend on you. We depend on your donations to keep this operation going. And tick, 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 ticking beneath our profiles and avatars are the all of the locations where you can donate to Countercurrents. Now, if you use Entropy, that's entropystream.live/countercurrents, right? You can ask me questions. You can ask Hvitgerd questions. You can even wish us a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, or so I've been told at any rate. And we will read out your question. We will read out your comments. And insofar as you pose a question, we will do our darndest to answer it. We will try our best. All I can give you sometimes is my honest uncertainty, but it is the best I can give you. And of course, you can also use Cash App. Now, on Cash App, you cannot ask me questions. You cannot even attach a message to the donation, but they do take a lesser percentage for the transaction than Entropy. So if you just want to give out of the goodness of your heart, since it is, of course, the season of giving, right? You can use Cash App for that. Now, we also have MoonPay. What you do on MoonPay is you use your credit card, you use your plastic, your fiat currency to buy cryptocurrency, and it goes straight into the Countercurrents wallet. And we put it towards the fundraiser. We put it towards all of the activities you people like, the new articles, the shows, the everything that Countercurrents does. Is paid for by your money. And then you have, we're lemonized on DLive. You can send us lemons, you know, when what they say, when life gives you lemons, you cash them out at the end of the year and tally up how much money you made. And we've been getting a lot of lemons this year on DLive, but hey, what can I say? It's never too late for lemons. We take lemons, we take ice creams, ninjets, ninja geezies, even the elusive diamond. And with donations of diamond and higher, you can also post comments and questions over on DLive. And there's, of course, also Odyssey. On Odyssey, you can send us cash money And you can send us their very own library coin, which is their homegrown Odyssey cryptocurrency. And I'm not sure about the conversion rate of library coin to actual cash money, but you know, it helps us upload replays of this shows, of the Countercurrents Radio, of interviews, and Jonathan Bowden speeches up to the Countercurrents Odyssey profile, because Odyssey is apparently pay to play. You have to spend library coin to keep your videos up there. So, you know, every little bit helps. And those are all the direct ways in which you can support Countercurrents and help us in this fundraiser. Reminder, we have a $2,000 matching grant going here. And but there is also an indirect way in which you can support Countercurrents. And that is to purchase the fine products of our sponsor, Alaska Chaga. The perfect winter drink, the perfect Christmassy tea. It's they scrape the fungus off of the birch trees and off of the mulberry trees up in Alaska, and it's full of antioxidants. In every forest, in every mulberry forest, there is a mushroom. It's sometimes called chaga. We also have chaga nationalism, but about that another time. And of course, Mr. Alaska Chaga is not only selling tea, he is also selling soap. And you cannot see it, and you probably cannot smell it, because Countercurrents super science has not advanced that far so far, unless the guys at the labs have invented something since last time I checked. But I just bathed and used Alaska Chaga soap, and now I smell divine, and I am squeaky clean, and are ready to. This is why I'm so chipper today. You know, usually I've been very demure lately, but one scrub of the old chaga soap, and it's like I swallowed a pound of Mr. White's best blue sky. And that is, I believe, all of the crass financial concerns we have for tonight. And without further ado, oh, we have a donation. It's an early donation from Dino Legovich. He gives $3, and he says, season's greetings. Well, season's greetings to you, Dino Legovich, and a Merry Christmas. You know, I hear that saying Merry Christmas can annoy certain people of the long-nosed persuasion, so I'm just going to say Merry Christmas, Christ Mass, Merry. Quidgeard, we are here to discuss Christmas lore. We are here to discuss the end of year celebrations, the Christmas, the winter solstice as processed, as commemorated by white people, by Europeans. But first, tell me, what have you been doing since the last time you were on this show?
Well, last time I was on, it was for Bonfire Night, talking about Guy Fawkes and V for Vendetta. Since then, I've just been busy with various home projects. While Whityard is a channel for talking about politics and various social commentary, I do have a lot of other issues in my personal life and various other projects that I keep to myself. So I've just been busy with that, busy working and preparing for Christmas and Yule.
Yes, it seems every time we have you on, it's one holiday or the other. But we do have many reasons to celebrate. We do have many commemorations. The calendar is full of these celebrations. It's full of these commemorations of Time's Long March. And it's the 11th of December today. Pretty soon it's going to be the Feast of St. Nicholas, according to the Orthodox calendar. When is the Feast of St. Nicholas in the West?
I believe it's the 6th, so it's already passed. But prior to that is, especially in the Alpine regions and in Bavaria, is Krampusnacht, just on the night before the Mass of St. Nicholas. But we'll talk more about that later.
Right. And, of course, because here in the East we retain the Julian calendar and not the we do not use the Gregorian calendar for our religious holidays, the Feast of St. Nicholas will fall on the 18th of December. And that's usually a hectic time in my life, because people may have noticed I am named Nicholas, and name days are kind of a big deal in Orthodox Christianity. So And it's also my grandfather's name day because he was also named Nicholas, another proud Macedonian tradition, naming your kid after your father. And which I don't know if I should be continuing, but it will be an interesting time. It is, of course, what we call a lean feast. It is in the middle of the Christmas fast. So before Christmas, we fast. We should theoretically, of course, abstain from eating meat and even oil and animal products. As of course, we should also abstain from sexual activity and unclean activity in general, including some of the professions. Not a lot of people observe this because, and personally, I found that if I observe the Orthodox fast, I'm likely to fall apart. And kids, this is why you shouldn't race mix, because at some point in the future, your descendants may find it necessary to consume a Mediterranean cuisine on German metabolism, which is not a pleasant experience. But it's very interesting to me how in the West, for whatever reason, St. Nicholas has become Santa Claus. Now, of course, he was the Bishop of Myrna, right? This is a town in what was Anatolia. And people say, oh, St. Nicholas, Santa Claus is Turkish. No, he wasn't. He was a Byzantine of indeterminate ethnicity, right? Well,
yes.
I guess if we tried really hard, we could determine it because we do have his mortal remains. They are in Italy somewhere, I believe. But he was a European, right? He might have been a little dark-skinned, a Mediterranean European, but he was definitely not modern Turk. He was definitely not non-white. And he was the Bishop of Myrna, and he was noted for his generosity. There is a tale that in the town of Myrna, right, where St. Nicholas was bishop, there was a poor man who had three daughters. And they couldn't marry because they had no dowry. So what the bishop did was, you know, what the St. Nicholas did was, when the girls were sleeping and they had left their socks out to dry on the windowsill, right, he threw money in their socks so they could have dowries and marry. He did this for the first daughter. He did this for the second daughter. But for the third daughter, he couldn't do it because it was a very cold night. It was middle of December, some people say. And so St. Nicholas, in order to put money in the girl's sock, he climbed the house and went down the chimney and put the money in the girl's sock that way. He was not just a saint. He was also a very nimble house climber and, significantly slimmer than Santa Claus. He did fit down that chimney, you know. He was also a religious fanatic who struck the heretic Arian at the Council of Nicaea, and for that he was divested as a bishop because, you know, he was a guest of the emperor. He shouldn't be like that. But overnight he prayed to Jesus and the Virgin Mary, and they reinvested him with the vestments of a bishop in his cell. Impressed by that, the Emperor Constantine reinvested him as a secular ruler as well. And that's one of the many, many stories of St. Nicholas. He's the patron saint of children, of the poor, of sailors for some reason. Many things, really, venerated in both Eastern and Western Christianity. And a very interesting figure. At one point, I believed him to be a sort of Odinic figure. But this is where we get into your wheelhouse, Quitgert. So tell me, is St. Nicholas an Odinic figure?
In some ways, yes. But probably more the equivalent that we have in England, which is Father Christmas. And Father Christmas does have a lot of similarities to Odin. For one, one of the names for Odin in Gylfaginning was Jolnir, which is the Yule one. And he's also called the Jolfather, which is the Yule Father. And that seems to be a very similar title to Father Christmas. But Father Christmas's origins do seem to have a lot of heathen roots. However, it was first mentioned in the 15th century, so not until the late Middle Ages that he seems to come into writings. And he's associated with feasting and revelry and merriment in times of midwinter. But yeah, every sort of continuation with Father Christmas, he seems to have these attributes which don't seem to be personified in a person until much later. So a lot of these characters that weren't represented until later may have come from a pre-Christian source. But in those celebrations, there was the choosing of a king or a lord of misrule. And that's very similar to a lot of traditions in the Middle Ages that would involve a sort of feast of fools, and also the Roman Saturnalia, which would involve the loosing of traditional boundaries and morals of where the slave would become masters and masters would become slaves. So there was this kind of a loosening of the rules and boundaries during this time. And much like with how in Halloween, the sort of a veil between the living and the dead becomes thinner. In the same way, during Yule, the boundaries between particular social elements seem to become thinner, and that allows for this revelry and feasting and celebrations. However, there's a lot of events that were used for Father Christmas after he became a lot more popular in the English consciousness. He was celebrated in a lot of folk plays and various songs, and this was especially during the Stuart and Tudor period as well. And but it seems that this Lord of Misrule character seemed to have not been quite favourable during the English interregnum and civil wars, because no one in the ruling elite seemed to have any care for this sort of Lord of Misrule character when they had genuine misrule in the social climate. And during the Puritan period of Oliver Cromwell, Father Christmas was pretty much banned, or at least Yule traditions in general, since Yule itself was the traditional word for this time of year. And they gradually became replaced by Christmas around the 11th century. But Christmas is pretty much Christmas in name only, because it still carried on the Yule traditions. And what's quite interesting about the name of Yule, it comes from a Proto-Germanic Yechola. And this Yech part of it seems cognate with Latin Jocus, which is where we get the word joke. And both seem to come from the root yek, which means to speak. So it seems to have this common root in merriment, in singing, in plays, in having times of jest and fun. But what's interesting about the actual name of Yule, it seems to be very similar to our word for wheel, which was from Indo-European Queklos, and this Queklos gives us Kuklos in Greek, which is where we get the word cycle. But in Germanic, it gives us Huechol, and this Huechol word, you can tell it sounds a bit awkward in the middle, but the our word wheel comes from the plural form, which becomes softened in Old English to Huechol. And so our word wheel is technically the plural form of huechol. And the same is true for yule as well. This yechola, in its plural form, it's yeol, which is where we get the word from in English. So technically, our word for yule is a plural in itself. Even though we use it in a singular form, its meaning is plural. So it's much like how German has Weihnachten for their word for Christmas, which is the Holy Nights. And it's important to stress that this seems to have the connotation that Yule isn't just a singular day. It's not just Christmas Day. It is a series of nights. And indeed, for the Anglo-Saxons, they had 2 whole months of it, or for the Germanic people as a whole. In Old English, the word, season, or the month of December was called Ere Yule, which was Ere Yule, or before Yule. And then January was After Yule, which was after Yule. So in their calendar dating system, it was based on their solar lunar system of dating. And they'd date the month according to the full moon. So rather than using the Julian or Gregorian dating system, Yule would be the day which fell right in the middle of these two full moons, which could shift the dating system across days, or eventually as a gradual shift, it could even pass traditions into the new year. And a lot of the traditions associated with Christmas and Yule would involve a lot of the wassailing, which still carries on in the carol singing tradition as well. But England, generally, the wassailing tradition carries on into January, where there's the wassailing of the trees to increase the harvest of apple trees. And this has been pushed forward into January. And this might be a throwback to when Yule might have fallen into January, purely because of the dating of the old calendar system. However, I seem to have gotten quite a bit sidetracked there. But
that's very interesting, because you know, you hear this, like, people think it's very clever that, oh, you put your Christmas decorations up too soon, it's still, you know, November. Like, you know, in America, people put up their Christmas decorations, from what I understand, as soon as Thanksgiving is done. And Thanksgiving is a is an autumn feast, by a late November feast by Americans. And I spoke about this with Jim Goat. He asked me a very good question. Do we have like a Thanksgiving equivalent here in Macedonia? I would say the Feast of St. Demetrius is probably the closest equivalent, because it serves the same social function. It's mid to late December. You get together with family and get you know, stuffed, get ungodly. You eat ungodly amounts of food and you spend it in the company of family. And with this, when the context of this information you're bringing here to me is that, so putting up your Christmas decorations out of season, or starting the Christmas season after Thanksgiving, might actually be in keeping with the ancient Germanic tradition. That's very interesting.
Yeah, but it seems that rather than just dating it in December and putting up your decorations in December, Christmas and Yule is it's a whole long period that can last for 2 months, and it shouldn't be seen as something that only exists for one day at a time. It is the entirety of December. So a lot of these traditions, a lot of what we do throughout Christmas time, it should last the entire month. It should be a whole celebration that lasts a long time because of its significance and because of its importance.
Right. I will just add another insight here from the East. In Macedonia, right, and other Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox countries, I think, the Christmas season, like we treat it as a season, I would say begins with the Feast of St. Nicholas on the 18th of December, but ends with the Feast of Epiphany on the 18th of January. So that's a full month there, and you have a lot of celebrations. First, you have St. Nicholas, then you have New Year's Eve, right, on the 31st of December, and then New Year. And then you have Orthodox Christmas on the 7th of January, which is, you know, a two-day celebration most of the time. Then you have the Feast of St. Basil, or, you know, the Julian calendar New Year on the 14th of January. And then you have Epiphany on the 18th. And that's a lot of feasts. That's a lot of food and drink and family, yeah, and gifts packed into a single month. And each has a unique ritual, right? And they vary regionally. I was recently asked by someone who wants to write, like, I guess, a country profile of Macedonia. What do we do for Christmas and related holidays? And I had a hard time answering the question because we have so much regional variation in these traditions around St. Basil's and around Epiphany and around Christmas. It's amazing. I think that there is something about that. And I remember reading recently in Mircea Eliade's Sacred and the Profane that a religious man's sense of time is that time is a thing which is similar to a thread and a wheel, but also a thread which gets worn out over time and has to be reconsecrated periodically. And precisely because of the impending reconsecration by the novation of the calendar, by the renewal of the calendar, I believe that this moral laxity and social laxity of Yule is meant to represent the wearing out of time. The institutions of society, such as servitude and masterhood and property and marriage, because we are nearing the end of the year, have become worn out by the passage of time. And because these institutions, right, have been established by the gods, and they themselves are being worn out by time. And so to symbolize the need for their consecration, the binds in which they put men become loosened during the end period of the year. This is Mircea Eliade's insight into the time cycle as seen by religious men, and he observed this not only in Europe, not among only among Europeans, but among all peoples which have a sense of the passage of time and a means of measuring it, which is usually religious. Calendars are always a religious affair. The year revolves around feasts and celebrations, especially in the Indo-European traditions. There are, I believe, 16 major feasts of the year, which all or was it 8? I forget. But in any case, that's one way of looking at it, the wheel of time turning, but also the thread of time wearing thin and becoming threadbare, needing to be reconsecrated by these feasts, by these celebrations, and by the rituals of the holy night. It is a holy night, not just because Jesus was born, but because we start time anew in this all holy night. And of course, we end, even in this modern and fallen age, we end the year with a bacchanalia. What do people do on New Year's Eve? They get blackout drunk. They kiss strangers. They sit at home and think about how the girl they like is kissing someone else on New Year's Eve. They kiss under mistletoe. Of course, kissing here stands in for something else, but this is a family show and we're discussing Christmas. But have you got anything to say about that strange and raucous Saturnalia at the end of the year we practice?
Well, yeah, I'd agree with the commentary of Eliade about the thinning of the thread. But a lot of the Yuletide traditions are very much bound up into the idea of pushing away evil spirits and harmful entities that are bound in the winter, and about ushering in a whole new cycle of the year. And myth in itself refers to timeless events. It's events which don't happen in our physical historical time, but they do happen in a reality that is timeless. And ritual is the imitation of mythic and heavenly events on earth. So to perform a ritual is to imitate, perform a ritual in our real time is to recreate and re-embody on earth these timeless and heavenly events that happen in myth. So by performing rituals here on earth and committing these Christmas and Yuletide events, we imitate and reenact a myth that is timeless, and in doing so, we shape the cosmic order. And that's essentially what Christmas and Yuletide is themed around. It's the turning of the wheel to begin the recreation of cosmic order again, and the turning of the cycle. And what's quite interesting is that Bede himself, the Anglo-Saxon monk and historian, the Venerable Saint Bede, he's a major source for what we know about Christmas and our dating calendar. He wrote a book called De Temporum Ratione, which is on the measurement or reckoning of time. And in this, he points out that the heathens of England before Christianity, that they measured their new year as beginning on December 25th. So we have it directly from Bede that the 25th of December was originally considered the new year rather than in January. But this sort of this seems to give a good source and a good basis for these events being the cause of that continuation of the cycle, because if Yule was when the new year began, we can see a lot of the Yuletide traditions as being bound to the initiation of the new year and the re-emergence of a cosmic beginning, and clearing away the old and evil spirits. And a lot of these traditions that involve banishing these evil spirits are happening in a lot of European traditions, whether it's figures like the English Father Christmas, whether it's the Celtic Father Winter, and Slavic has Djed Moroz, or Morozko, which is Father Frost. So you have these figures that seem to embody the winter, and they seem to be involved in attacking or going against these harmful spirits which embody the winter and seem to cause the decay and death of life. And there's also an element of ancestral worship as well involved in Yule, like in a lot of Slavic traditions. So I know that they'll often have a feast for their family, often vegetarian, and they'll leave out the food after for their ancestors and the dead to eat after that, and they'll light candles for the dead, which is also involved in a lot of traditions, like in Sweden as well for Saint Lucia. They'll visit the site of the dead. So Yule seems to be a time of remembrance, a time for honouring the ancestors, and for making sure that these Christmas meals we have, these ritualized feasts, also involve the acknowledgement of ancestors and to have those ancestors there with us for those feasts. What was also quite interesting is that this sort of killing the old year to begin the new has various other traditions elsewhere, like in Celtic tradition in Wales and Ireland. There seems to be a very clear-cut a tradition of killing a wren, and a wren only appears around Christmas, so it's quite a very rare bird, but it does seem to have the connotation of representing winter itself. And there'll be traditions of where boys would be sent to hunt the wren, and they'll kill it, put it in a box, and they'd go about the town showing people the dead wren in the box, and people would give them gifts. So that's another element of the gift-giving tradition. And in the Scottish.
It's interesting to me, right? Because there is a Slavic tradition, right? Not to kill winter itself, but to at this time, but at the break of spring, so at the spring equinox, right? Morana, depends on which language is it. The goddess of winter is ritualistically drowned and then burned in effigy. I don't know how that works. Somehow it did for the ancient Slavs, or maybe it's two different traditions depending on the tribe at the spring equinox. But there is a consistent theme of the year is winding down and we are tying up its loose ends, right? We are tying up the loose threads of time so that we can begin anew next year. And of course, I'm reminded, like you mentioned Ded Moroz in Macedonia, he is Dedo Mraz, right? Grandfather Frost. Dedo is actually grandfather in the Slavic languages, Did or Ded in the Eastern Slavic languages. And I can remember very vaguely watching as a child a Christmas play where his evil brother, right, who was called Mrazoded, right? So it's an inversion of Dedo Mraz, Father Frost, yeah. Frost grandfather, right? Who commanded an army of ghosts intended to steal his bag full of gifts, right? And enlisted the help of naughty children to do it. And over time, you know, you watch it and you think, yeah, this is like something silly for children when you think back to it. But now that you mention it, it's probably rooted in some sort of folklore about an evil spirit or, of, you know, Santa Claus's evil twin brother trying to mess things up for Christmas. And one of my fondest Christmas memories, so I'm just walking down memory lane now. You're trying to educate the audience, but here I am hogging time with my stories. I remember watching a Christmas play as a child, because that's another, I guess it's not a really a tradition, it's modern, but I liked it, where Batman and Robin were helping Santa Claus because the Joker not only wanted to steal his bag, but also deprive the city of electricity during Christmas. So everyone's celebration would be ruined. And I'm thinking, in this modern world, do we really have a better avatar of chaotic evil, of demonic energy, than the Joker, really? I mean, and why wouldn't Batman, who is a knight for justice and good and wisdom and all of those positive adjectives, help Santa Claus in his crusade to defeat evil? It really gets the nogging jogging. This is a children's play, but children's plays have very powerful archetypes in them, very primal archetypes, because, you know, people assume children are going to be satisfied by poor storytelling, but I do think that children have, in as general rule, a higher threshold for storytelling, a higher standard than adults. Adults want to be entertained because our lives are dramatic enough, but children, they need the drama. They need the strong archetypal interplay. They need Batman and Robin to save Christmas from the Joker. I'm sorry, do continue.
It does seem like a eternal mythopoetic theme that seems to manifest itself in the Batman stories. It's almost like an ancient myth has found a modern form in that. And indeed, carrying on the theme from that, in fact, you mentioned about saying that the Joker would be the sort of demonic entity that would be alongside it. Well, this ties back to the Western traditions that were associated with St. Nicholas, because he seemed to develop a life of his own here in the West. A lot of the relics of his body were traded, and his tomb was deemed sacred, of course. But there was this sort of strange manner in the tomb, like a sort of weird vapour there. And that was said to have healing properties for those who visited his tomb. But having the manor that would develop around his tomb was was a good source for healing. And a lot of these traditions seemed to develop shortly after his death. That was around 343. But due to a Muslim invasion, his remains had to be taken from Anatolia, and I'm guessing that's why they're currently in Italy. But this sort of association...
They're in the city of Bari, right? And yeah. The remains of St. Nicholas, recently, I mean, How recently? I'm not sure. Yeah, last year, St. Nicholas's face was reconstructed from these remains. And it's amazing to me just how much he looks like the Orthodox icons. I'm trying to track down the file to share it with our audience. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, this is the face of St. Nicholas, Bishop of Myrna, and he looks almost exactly like Orthodox iconography portrays him. It's yeah. Amazing, right? This is why, I mean, this and other reasons, they have taught me not to doubt reconstructions of historical or representations of historical figures, because the artists of the past, they knew what they were doing. They were representing these people as they were.
Yeah, there seems to be quite a particular style about a lot of Orthodox arts. But even down to the facial proportions of the reconstruction, it does seem to be very similar to a lot of the depictions of St. Nicholas in Orthodox art. So it's not just a product of that artistic style.
Exactly. So that's I'm sorry, I interrupted you again.
Oh, sorry. The traditions like around the veneration of his bones. That seemed to give Christmas this very sort of, well, it seemed to give the figure of St. Nicholas this very, very macabre and very morbid character. And a lot of the traditions around him seemed to develop in that sort of path in Western traditions. So these sort of dark themes led to various literature about him. And even the Norman poet, Wace, he was famous for writing that the epic poem Bret, which claims that Britain was founded by the descendants of Brutus. And that's a famous Norman story. But in the poems of Wace, he talks about St. Nicholas and about how St. Nicholas accuses this couple who were in this inn, who were involved in chopping up travellers, and specifically schoolboys. And this seemed to develop in various other paths where, because of the importance of talking about schoolboys who would be chopped up by these people at this inn. And St. Nicholas is the moral figure who accuses them of their crime and where they become punished for it. There's this sort of system of pedagogy where children are morally lectured for their behaviour and made sure that they don't misbehave. So you can see where I'm going with this path here. And this seemed to develop into a lot of medieval stage plays as well, and a lot of mystery plays and activity with mummers. And this seems to have Santa Claus as St. Nicholas, especially around Germany. Around Germany, a lot of the Bavarian and Alpine regions of where St. Nicholas would be used to act as a moral didact. So he'd help to teach people about good moral behaviour and to make sure that those who behaved well, especially children, would be rewarded, and that those who were very naughty would become punished. And in order to have this, they these mystery plays seem to develop a sort of a sidekick, a character who would be alongside St. Nicholas. And originally this was Satan, who'd be used for the moral plot of condemning those who misbehaved, while St. Nicholas would, based on the previous story that you mentioned earlier about rewarding the three sisters with their wedding dowry, this made sure that St. Nicholas was a character of giving and giving gifts and rewards for moral behaviour. And in the Bavarian story in the 13th century, the Benedict Bauern, that has Satan as the character for as a sort of infernal side of the divine versus infernal. And this seems to develop further during the Reformation, where the Catholic tradition seemed to really cement on this idea of Saint Nicholas and his sort of immoral counterparts, in order to make sure that it enforces a strict moral standard. And these seem to develop later into characters like the Antichrist and Lucifer, and eventually you get King Herod as well. And the story of the slaughter of the innocents is a large moral story in these medieval mystery plays. And that seems to terrify people and make sure that they don't misbehave. And
a little aside, Whitgerd, I know you, this is probably not something you studied up for, but have you noticed that just how much, I guess, that story of the slaughter of the innocents by King Herod inhabits our imagination and our terrors really as a civilization? Because like it or not, European civilization is a Christian civilization. I keep hearing these stories of how our ruling elite, they're all pedophiles, they all rape children, they all eat children, they all sacrifice children. Now, this could be true or not. I'm not going to get into it. How much of it do you think is informed by this notion of the slaughter of the innocents? I'm really getting some King Herod vibes, narrative-wise, from the story that our elites are all secret satanic pedophiles.
Yeah, it does seem to. The slaughter of innocents is a very core theme in a lot of Western traditions as well. But whether it informs their behavior, I really can't say. But
I wasn't talking about the behavior of the elite. I was talking about the narrative which you hear about the elites, that they are satanic pedophiles. And I'm not going to say they're not, because I haven't seen all that much evidence to suggest they're not satanic pedophiles. But there is a certain, there is like an obsession, I would say, with this idea that they are slaughtering the innocents or about to slaughter the innocents any second now. It would appear that every idea of a bad ruler we have is normalized down to King Herod in our psyche, I guess.
Yeah, but he does seem to have been replaced in recent years by a new historical figure who represents that same mythic trope. And of course, that is a particular German painter. He's replaced the same character of King Herod in the modern consciousness. So he's playing that same
The specificity of crimes against children is absent. It would appear as if he's a sort of alien archetype to our psyche. We're supposed to hate this guy, but did he really do something as atrocious as slaughter the innocents? Well, of course, not the children. He is alleged to have slaughtered other people, but, you know.
Well, he could always be a figure of propaganda.
Mm, right. There is something about that. There is something to say. But do continue. Yes. So St. Nicholas, he's not alone. He has a friend or a slave in certain interpretations, a demon hewed to his will. Someone with a very, very long tongue, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, this demonic figure, who's often Satan, he tends to carry a bag or a sack for capturing naughty children. And this character developed further in a lot of German and Dutch traditions. In Germany, they have a Knecht Ruprecht. And Knecht is the same as our English word knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. And originally it was a servant or an attendant who would help and support someone. And this figure would be, he'd have a black face, which is darkened with soot and ashes. And he'd carry a switch of twigs in order to whip and punish people. And in Dutch traditions, they have a Zwarte Piet, which is Black Pete. And traditionally, he's known as a blackamoor. So there's that seems to cause quite a lot of controversy over the fact that he's quite openly based on a Moorish figure, and he's had accusations of trying to cancel Shvad Piet by accusing it of being racist. But this whole sort of blackface tradition does seem to have a much older basis to it. It might be that these blackface represent the dead souls who would be in Odin's army during the Wild Hunt, during Takis's histories. He talks about the Germanic tribes, and he mentioned a particular tribe who would blacken their face to hide and camouflage. And this particular tribe does seem to be the sort of earthly embodiment of Odin's Wild Hunt army, the Einherjar. And these sort of blackened face may represent the sort of darkened spirits of the dead. So they'd embody the spirits of the dead by painting their face black. And this sort of ancient Germanic tradition may carry on into the into how characters like Knecht Ruprecht and Schwarz Piet would be in this sort of companion for St. Nicholas. And of course,
circling back to St. Nicholas as an Odinic figure, insofar as he would have like a black faced companion who was part of the kingdom of the dead, right?
Yeah, but it does seem to be that if St. Nicholas and Father Christmas, in their merging over time through European traditions, have this black-faced companion. That does seem to be quite a parallel to Odin as the Yule Father, with his army of the dead souls, the Einherjar. Because one of the particular traits about Odin, especially in less so in the later traditions you see in Norse literature, but Odin is a sort of a psychopomp, a leader of the dead souls. During the winter nights, and Wild Hunt tradition, this was called in German the Wütendeheer, the sort of the woad or raging army, and this seems to call back Wotan or Odin as the leader of this Wild Hunt, and whether this sort of psychopomp nature of Odin dates back to Roman traditions, because Mercury was famously the psychopomp figure in Roman tradition. It may be a character that the Germanic peoples absorbed through their contact with Rome, especially with many Germanic soldiers fighting in the Roman armies. They may have taken this character of this sort of psychopomp nature of Mercury, and it would have developed into the Woden cults in Germania. Or it may have been a natural trait that was already within Woden, but he does seem to be the leader of these nocturnal spirits of the dead throughout the night.
And, before the Roman tradition and the German tradition could have a common root.
Right? Exactly,
which is very likely given the shared Indo-European heritage of both these religious and linguistic traditions, because we see similar phenomena in Slavic mythology. Of course, here I would say stewardship over the dead is divided between Morena and Veles, right? And Veles, he's a psychopomp, but he's also a dragon, and he's also Perun's brother. It's not well documented, so there's a lot of overlap. That's interesting. That's interesting that the pedagogic angle, of course, Santa Claus rewards, but his companions punish, and punishment, of course, is an element of pedagogy. So if you don't punish your children, they're going to come out spoiled, and just ask my mother. even modern day Santa Claus, right? He denies gifts to naughty children. He puts coal in their socks, which, you know, it's symbolic in some way. I guess it's symbolic in the sense of he sort of threatens to turn you into Svarte Pet, right? He's going to blacken your face. He's going to kill you, and then you're going to be his slave.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to punish all the naughty children. So there's an origin story for Svarte Pet that people may have not thought of. But there are these disturbing aspects, well, quote unquote, disturbing aspects of Christmas. We consider them, I guess, disturbing because we live in an age where we underestimate the ability of children to handle moral instruction, right? You say, well, if you tell children that Krampus is going to drag them into hell, no, Satan is going to drag them into hell, or Krampus is going to put them in his sack, or Odin's going to conscript them for his wild hunt, they're going to have nightmares. But the reality of it is, man is a moral being. Our morality is as much a necessary part of us as our livers and kidneys and teeth are. It's an organ. Something I guess people forget just how much of our biology is up here, right? How much of our biological being is running on an emulator, really, just so, just for efficiency, just because our brains are such an efficient organ which can perform everything. Our culture is a biological category. And it's important to impart these lessons. It's important to impart that immoral behavior has negative consequences. And I think that's a very characteristically European trait. Because we are Europeans, we are white people, we have evolved in very harsh winter conditions. And immorality, understood as dishonesty, as theft, as lies, or adultery, you know, another big one we ignore in this modern day age, gluttony, eating more than your fill, sloth, refusing to work, pride, refusing to submit to law and authority. These all meant death in the European world. You get a little leeway, right, in the Middle East and Africa, maybe even in Southern Europe, but Northern Europe, this means death, and not just for you, but for your entire tribe. If you steal from your neighbor during winter, you kill your neighbor. If you refuse to share with the tribe dies, and you die with the tribe because, hey, you can't survive alone. And for this reason, man in general, but European man most of all, I think, has a necessity for moral instruction and moral behavior, which far outstrips that of non-white women. And that's why we have this, you could call it a hyper-moralistic Weltanschauung as white people, which is our greatest strength and our greatest weakness. Because we are these hyper-moralistic creatures, we cannot build kin-based community. It's always a morality-based community. It's always an ethics-based community with us. It's always not who he is, but whether he does good. Even those among us who are racial and ethnic identitarians are like this, whether we like it or not, because we are white people. I don't think we can really change that about us. And I don't think I would. I don't think I would. I think that our myths represent our evolution, our nature as biological beings, and they're as much part of us as our organs are. What do you think, Hvitgeir? This hyper-moralistic European way of looking at the world, the imprint it has had on our culture and our celebrations, tell us more about it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. We are quite very individualistic people. We live in a very cold and harsh environment. So the source of our morality and the source of our general collectivism does come from the fact that that sort of loyalty to one another, the importance of maintaining oaths to each other, and maintaining that sense of community and strength is what binds who we are. It's what makes us able to survive in these harsh environments. It's how we build the strength of our community.
Indeed. And speaking of community, speaking of mutual respect and keeping oaths and mutual support, we have Slog breaking the ice over on DLive, donating 14 lemons. Well, let me see if I can get this right. Kiitos se truesta, as they say in his homeland of Finland, right? And thank you for that, Slog. So you may have donated 14 lemons, and that's a very interesting number. We would like to see it conceptually completed, because it looks incomplete to me. Like, there's another two numbers that should be appended right there. But you have actually donated 28 lemons, because every donation will be matched up to $2,000. Yes, people, we have a matching grant for Countercurrents for the duration of this fundraiser. Every dollar you donate will be matched up to the amount of $2,000. So if you donate a dollar, you're donating $2. If you donate $10, you're donating $20. If you're donating, say $88, you're actually donating $176. And that's, you can quote me on that. And speaking of that, Norse Nature just donated a diamond on DLive. And of course, that donation will be doubled under our matching grant policy. Thank you for that, Norse Nature. And speaking of Norse Nature, right, let's go further into the folklore of the Germanic peoples, because it's very fascinating to me how we got to Christmas as it is today. That's very interesting, because a lot of people, you're going to say, oh, Christmas was invented in the Victorian era, or Christmas was invented by Coca-Cola, like Santa Claus is a Coca-Cola salesman. And, you know, what can I say? A man's got to make a living. Here I am hawking chaga, Alaska chaga, fungal teas to online racists. But there is something very, I would say, Santa Claus, the Coca-Cola salesman, would have not been such a successful figure had he not been able to activate some primeval archetypes in the psyche of people. But just how modern is Christmas, Hoetgerd, or is it something more ancient?
Well, of course it is ancient in its source, but that modern character of Santa Claus, how he's depicted in his... rather than his traditional mitre and green cloak, the replacement with his red cloak with the hat, and driving a sleigh, pulled by flying reindeer. All this seems to have been developed by a man named Clement Clark Moore, who was an American, and he wrote a poem in 1820 called A Visit from St. Nicholas. And this sort of American Santa Claus was brought over from the Dutch Sinterklaas. So a lot of the traditions associated with the modern Santa Claus is very much American, but that seems to derive from a very much Dutch depiction.
Just so much of American culture, which is on loan or given from the Dutch culture. We think so much about the English and French roots of America. We forget that the Dutch were there. They were there before the English in the city of New Amsterdam, right? And their culture influences the culture of New York, or New Amsterdam, as it was known before that, to this very day. And this city is very culturally dominant in America, very influential. So, you know, there is a Dutchness to America, which maybe we should explore at a different time, but it is there and we should be aware of it. Do continue, Quid.
Okay. Well, while the name of Santa Claus does come from Dutch, the general depiction of the modern Santa Claus, which has ultimately replaced a lot of European traditions who have been re-influenced via the American depiction. So, for example, in places like Scandinavia, during the 19th century, that rather than having a figure like Father Christmas delivering gifts, they had a figure called the Julebock, who someone would dress up as a goat, and he'd go delivering gifts and presents to people and seek people at their doors. But eventually now Scandinavia has the classic Santa Claus because of the wider American influence. So a lot of places, and even in a lot of Eastern Europe, they've also adopted the traditional Americanized Santa figure. But it's not really America that's responsible for this standardization of Santa Claus. It's actually Germany. Germany still tends to promote this this Christmas market and the association of things like wooden huts, a lot of sweets as gifts, rich sugary desserts, candy canes, and things like that. And this is all for me a very German, a very Bavarian, and a very Alpine view of Christmas. And even the central thing that a lot of us have in our homes, Christmas trees, is of German origin. Well, it may be of German origin. There's various theories for where the Christmas tree comes from. And some speculate that it's from Martin Luther, that he's responsible for the Christmas tree, or Lutherans in general. But it does seem that the earliest source of the Christmas tree seems to come from Latvia or around Estonia as well. But specifically the pine tree, because all throughout Europe, we've decorated our houses with plants, with flowers, and even trees as well. And of course, England has the Yule log tradition as well. And that does seem to be quite pagan, because it hasn't replaced the word Yule in its name. It didn't become the Christmas log. So it does seem to be specifically a pagan in origin, but we don't know what it originally served. But the Christmas tree is specifically a pine tree, and pine isn't native to Britain at all. It was brought in for cheap timber. And while Germanic tradition has its importance of the world tree, the Axis Mundi.
That's interesting. In Macedonia, we use a spruce.
Yeah.
Interesting. Not a pine. A spruce, which is, again, I mean, it's native to Macedonia, but more characteristic. Do continue, right?
That would be quite interesting if it did have its own independent origin for why they chose spruce. But it does seem that everyone now is using the pine tree, and the pine tree doesn't seem native to lots of places, which does have its Christmas tree tradition. And a lot of the trees we have a particular religious significance in Germanic tradition is the world tree, which is an ash, and the tree of Thunur, which is or Thor, and his sacred tree was an oak, and the yew was also held sacred as well. But none of these seem to be the same as the pine tree, which is quite particular in the Christmas tradition. But it seems that there's a...
Did you say that yew was associated with Thor?
Oh, no, the oak was.
All right. And yew is associated with whom?
We don't know, but it does seem to be held as a sacred tree.
Well, it was for the English, right? Yew Longbow saved England, right?
Exactly.
Right. Do continue.
Oh, sorry. Yes. The Christmas tree does seem to have, the pine Christmas tree has its origins in the Baltic, in Lithuania. And they'd have pine trees that would be decorated in the centre of the town rather than one at home. And there was a Christian brotherhood called the Brotherhood of the Blackheads. And these were Christian militants who were sent to Estonia to suppress a pagan uprising there. And a lot of these Brotherhood of the Blackheads were Germans. And they seemed to to uphold and maintain the land there to suppress this uprising. And in their guild hall, they perhaps they took the idea of this decorated pine tree from the Lithuanians or from around Estonia. But they seem to be the first people who were recorded as bringing this Christmas tree into their guild hall. Or perhaps it was something that was already associated with German people who, because they don't seem to, it doesn't seem that they'd borrow a pagan tradition. It seems equally likely that they already had a much more secularized version of it, which they still continue to practice without the pagan connotation. So they'd have this decorated pine tree. And this was brought back further down south into central Germany and around Prussia as well, where the this decorating of the Christmas tree was practiced. And Britain's king and queen from Victoria and Albert, they're of German origin. So we seem to have inherited our Christmas tree tradition from the British royal family. And once the royal family have a tradition like decorating their Christmas trees in their home, everyone else takes it. And that seems to be responsible for why people in Britain have Christmas trees in their homes, because it was popular with the royal family. But it seems
this tradition comes from Victoria and Albert.
Well,
the United Kingdom has, I think, the first ethnic German king of the United Kingdom is George the First, right? The first Hanover was he was George. So George the First, second, third, fourth, all the way to Victoria, they didn't have Christmas trees.
They certainly had Christmas trees, but there were a lot of woodcut artworks of Victoria and Albert decorating their tree, and they gave a lot of commentary about decorating the tree. So it does seem to be quite popular during the Victorian period.
Right, so before, because commoners, they did not have access to the king and his personal traditions, right? They did not emulate him in this way.
I don't know if they emulated George, but I do know that Victoria and Albert quite famously had depictions of their Christmas tree in art and spoke about it publicly. So I can only conjecture that that would be the time of transmission where people would imitate the German royal family.
That, I'm reminded of that scene in Blackadder where Captain Darling is being interrogated about being a German spy, and no, I'm not German, I'm as British as Queen Victoria. Ah, so you're half German, your father was a German, you married a German. Very suspicious, darling. And it's been mentioned, you mentioned the Christmas markets, and a big selling point for places like Vienna and Munich and you know, a lot of cities in Germany for tourists during the Yuletide period is just how amazing the Christmas markets are. And I guess through the influence of this global culture, even though, you know, we call it American, but as you say, it's probably German, people have been trying to set up Christmas markets here in Macedonia, even though they're not exactly traditional. We also have a big Christmas tree in the middle of town, or should at any rate. Corruption has ensured that this year my hometown of Skopje will not be decorated in any way. Or, you know, it's, the city itself is not going to decorate. Maybe private concerns will decorate their own property. I know I will be putting up some sort of decoration here. And of course, I want to thank Whitgert because he made a new avatar for me over on Telegram. He added to my, you know, usual avatar, which is a picture of me holding up a television screen. He added a Father Christmas hat, snow, and a better background. So I want to thank you for that. That was, it's really, right, it's one of those gestures which really are, really make this the season of giving. Speaking of giving, we have a donation from Slog Diamond over on DLive, and he says, Knicks and MASH. Well, thank you for that, sir, and I'm sure it will be MASH. The diamond is $1. I think it's convertible to $1, so I will make sure to let our people know. And everyone else, yeah, we still have some ways to go to meet that match. And Grand Countercurrents needs your help if we are to survive for another year to keep bringing you all this high quality content. And so, okay, so the origin of the Christmas tree and a lot of these Yuletide, well, Christmas traditions in Germany is all the way in Lithuania. And one thing we know about Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia, all these Baltic countries, is they are the last pagan lands of Europe. In fact, the Teutonic Knights tried for very long to Christianize these lands by force. Ultimately, I think they hammered out a deal with the Grand Duke of Lithuania or something like that happened. And finally, the Lithuanians converted to Christianity. But this is, I guess, the most pagan you can get on the European continent. And if it's true that these traditions come from Lithuania, I would say that's more weight on the side that says that, yeah, the Christmas tree is some sort of pagan tradition, which, as you said, could have possibly resonated with something already within the German soul. I remember like 100 years ago or something, I was listening to Stefan Molyneux wax poetic about the Christmas tree being essentially a miracle. It's what you see if you fall on your knees in a forest and perceive a tree, like a pine tree, from a frog's perspective, backlit by stars at night. I think he was trying to invoke Luther in a forest, or maybe Saint Benedict in a forest. But he was trying to associate Christmas with Germanness and with something else. I forget. It's a shame, really. When he was banned from YouTube, we lost so much of his material, and he really was really good. You know, Miss Old Molyneux. He had his shortcomings, but he was the one who red pilled me about race and IQ, and I'm never going to forget that. But yeah, about the Christmas tree. So what do you think it resonates with at our deep psychological level in the European psyche?
Well, I think this resonance has got quite an interesting feedback loop, especially during the Victorian period in Britain. We seem to have quite a deep romanticism. And this romanticism had a huge effect on how we see a lot of Christmas. Like, for example, our Father Christmas figure. Even though a lot of Yule was suppressed during Oliver Cromwell's influence, there was this sort of Merry England ideal that was brought about in the Victorian period. And this romanticism for a lost golden age. And interestingly, the Victorian period, they have fabricated a lot of traditions. They like to tie things to the past which aren't connected to the past because of this romanticism, and they like to show this continuous thread. And they seem to believe that that there was a lot more pagan elements in Christianity than they gave credit for. But also there are the exact opposites. There was a tradition that Saint Boniface cut down Donar's oak, which is Thunor or Thor, and he replaced it with a fir tree. And this was a symbol of the true God, whose evergreen never fails. And because of its triangular-like leaves, this was a symbol of the Trinity. But this tradition that seems to tie the Christmas tree to St. Boniface was invented in 1912 by a woman called Mary Louise Harvey. And she wrote a story called How St. Boniface Kept Christmas. And she seems to conflate it with a lot of traditions of Druids. And she just seems to borrow ideas directly from Pliny the Elder. But it seems to have an influence in trying to backdate when Christmas and Yule began. So you have this sort of interesting feedback loop during the Victorian period, which tends to try to root Yule and Christmas traditions in a much older period than they actually are. Even though throughout this discussion we've been talking about where its actual roots do lie, there's a lot of interesting conflation because of the Victorian Romanticism and how they seem to almost like they're longing back to the Romantic Golden Age creates a new form of Christmas, which then influences how we see Christmas and then reinterpret it about the past again. So you have this this sort of ever-changing feedback loop by how we interpret the past, and Christmas traditions do play a very central role in that. They seem to allow us to reinterpret the past through a new lens and a new perspective because of our romantic attachment to it.
Well, of course, the Victorian period overlaps with the Romantic period in literature. There is not just a resurgence of the pagan elements of Christmas. There is a resurgence in the pagan elements of everything in the Romantic period. Yes, of course, also the golden era of, old school nationalism, which I have problems with, I don't agree with, but it was what it was, I guess. And it's the era of men like, I'm going to embarrass myself. Was Byron of the Victorian era? I don't think so. Yeah, he was, actually. He was. He fought in the Greek War of Independence. That's there somewhere, right? But Byron is like the, Byron is the textbook romantic. You also have Shelley and all these people. These people harken back to the Europe's deep pagan past. They read all these stories about fairies, about fays, and about the ancient gods, and they try to rediscover the thread of pagan tradition in European cultural artifacts and cultural aspects. And of course, they sometimes overbuild. They sometimes forget just how deep just how shallow some cultural roots are, and on the other hand, how in the spirit of things they do. So when we say many Christmas traditions were quote-unquote invented by the Victorians, yes, the tradition itself may be very recent, but it took root in the soil, which is European man, which meant that it was a strong seed. And if it was a strong seed, then it was in accordance with our spirit, which hasn't changed all that much in these past 5,000, 10,000 years. How long have we been kicking around? Who even counts anymore? Certainly, I'm going to ask all the other immortals at the next meeting to give us an exact number. But it is, you know, there is this romanticism about Christmas, right, which persists well after the Victorian age, even though there have been attempts, as people have been pointing out in chat all evening, there are attempts to deconstruct Christmas, right, by a certain hostile tribe, notable for their poor hygiene and long noses, that so much that they're inventing all these holidays like Kwanzaa, or just writing Xmas instead of Christmas. They're trying to cross out Christ, take the Christ out of Christmas, literally. And of course, there is a war on Christmas, right? People are no longer saying Happy Christmas or Merry Christmas. They're saying Happy Holidays.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
Which is, I would say a deliberate attempt to remove Christmas from the public eye, precisely because it is a specifically European, and of course, it is a Christian thing, right? But the group we're talking about, they're not exactly Christian, are they?
No. Not exactly. The whole sort of Happy Holidays thing just seems to, it re-emphasizes the theme of multiculturalism. It basically tells you that there is no standard tradition in your nation, that in your nation, all Christmas holiday, well, all winter holidays are all equal, so they're all celebrated equally at once. So when they say happy holidays, they try to delegitimize any national traditions you have around Christmas in your own country and replace it with a general, well, something that's going to accept Hanukkah in there.
Right. It's the thing about Hanukkah is, until I would say the 20th century, the Jews did not think of it as a high holiday. I still don't think it's considered a high holiday in Judaism, or at least in Orthodox Judaism. It's really something they just pretended to do just to fit in into society, or maybe. Because, you know, the joke is, right, Jews get jealous on Christmas. Like that song from South Park, it's hard to be a Jew on Christmas. My friends don't let me join in any games, if only. If only. But there is that thing of, like, Jews, they get jealous on Christmas because they don't get to partake in the general cheer, because they're specifically not supposed to celebrate the birth of Jesus, because, you know, they have that old thing about the crucifixion and everything. And so I think that they hate Christmas in particular as a European holiday. I don't think I've ever seen this much rancor from Jews about Easter. At least not when Mel Gibson is involved. They really don't like Mel Gibson or his film about Easter, which is one of my favorite Easter movies, I gotta admit. And but I think that the specifically the way that they have tried to infiltrate our society in every way, and they have greatly succeeded, but Christmas is just that box they cannot unlock, that skin they cannot wear. If they try to wear it, they wear it badly. I remember that really embarrassing moment on Friends where Ross dressed up as a Hanukkah armadillo. You remember that? It was,
yeah.
I didn't catch too many episodes on Friends, but that one stuck out like a sore thumb in particular. Like, they're trying to force consciousness of this thing to me. Like, okay, I get it, right? Jews don't like Christmas. There is no Santa Claus-like figure for Judaism for Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah anyway? It's a, oh, Merry Christmas. Oh, I'm Jewish. Well, Happy Holocaust.
Well, interestingly, at Hanukkah, they celebrate that the Maccabees had slaughtered these Hellenized Jews. It's basically the celebration that Jews had prevented themselves from being influenced by Hellenized culture and had managed to retain their own independent traditions away from Hellenic influence. So it celebrates the victory of the Maccabees over a Hellenic conversion. So it basically just undermines their own worship of themselves and basically validates themselves. And it does seem, but it's a artificial celebration that was invented last Thursday just to compete with Christmas.
It's so in this resentment they have towards Christmas in particular, we see the direction of modern culture, you know, to essentially erase all Europeanness out of Christmas. There was that film Elf, right? It was so embarrassingly subversive. But there's also all this Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer stuff, which traditional carols about, tell us about traditional Christmas songs and how do they contrast with modern Christmas carols?
Well, lots of the Christmas carols we have do tend to be Christian in origin, but you get stuff like the We Wish You a Merry Christmas, and a line in that, give us some figgy pudding. This seems to originate in a very pre-Christian tradition that involves wassailing. And Also involves a lot of going to doors, doing other people's houses, doing a particular performance, whether that's a dance, performing a song, and being rewarded with some sort of treat. And this sort of tradition of going to different houses and getting gifts and rewarded is something that we'd normally associate with Halloween, but it's something that does have its roots in a lot of Yuletide traditions. And so that's a very sort of important core concept, the wassailing, singing carols, being rewarded with gifts like piggy pudding. But yeah, a lot of these carols I seem to recall from my childhood of having Christmas carolers come round to our house, and my family would give them sweets as a result, or a pound coin sometimes as well, as a reward. And nowadays, the carol singing just seems to have declined massively, and not just like because of the whole COVID thing as well. It just seems that there's been a steady decline in a lot of these traditions, which I put down to the breakdown of community. Once communities disappear, people just have no reason to go around to people's houses to sing Christmas songs. And the whole sense of community and Christmas spirit dies away once communities disappear and break down. So we need to have strong and homogenous communities that can allow traditions like carol singing to actually have some firm footing, because no one wants to knock on the door, face some 6 foot black man, and sing carol songs at him, only for him to get angry and fight you. You don't want that on Christmas.
Right, or an overly sensitive Indian or Pakistani deciding that it's his time of year to get offended because, well, actually, your racist colonialist religion is not welcome in this neighborhood, sweetie. It's in Macedonia and in other southern Slavic countries, we have the tradition of Kolada, right, which can be confusing because Kolada is the Bulgarian word for Christmas, but it's what happens is young children.
Interestingly, the word Kolada means calendar.
I know, yeah, calend. It comes from the Roman calends.
Yeah.
Right, so what happens is, right, little children, by tradition, until you're tall enough to reach the peephole on the door, but that's modern because, you know, peepholes are not traditional, but it's a good enough heuristic, right? You get a bag and you go door to door in your neighborhood, and you sing a song, right, which is about a beam falling on an old man and breaking him in half. But, you know, the old woman, she comes in and she lays a bunch of eggs on him, and he's going to get better. And then there's a calf involved, and he begs people not to slaughter him because he's going to make him a leek pie, right? It's a very catchy song. It's got mentioning of all sorts of waterfowl's eggs, you know, goose and ducks. And the tradition is, right, that the children are rewarded for performance of the song with sweets, with fruits, with, you know, nuts. Nuts are very important, not money, and candies, all right? And then the children bring these candies and fruits and nuts to the Christmas Eve table, because we have the last lean feast of the year is Christmas Eve, right? Well, before Christmas, because the fast ends with Christmas and we can finally eat meat. But on Christmas Eve, we eat lean because, you know, that's tradition. And we're supposed to eat fish, and there's got to be grain, right? And there's got to be Christmas bread, and we bake a coin into it. And the children contribute what they have gathered, the fruits, the nuts, the sweets, to the table so that everyone can have essentially a very merry Christmas Eve, a wholesome. That's another thing. Abundance is very important in this time. Abundance, we're saying, oh, what's Christmas about? Oh, you're going to eat turkey. You're going to stuff your face with turkey or with pork, right? The tradition of the South Slavic peoples is to eat pork on Christmas because, you know, it's after, I think, a 30-day fast. So that's pretty grueling. But you get all sorts of food. You overeat. Yes, you indulge your this sin, this vice of gluttony, communally, of course. And I think this is like an overreaction to the harshness of winter. I think that we use the abundance of the feast to symbolize life amidst the death of winter time. And of course, this year we are having a pretty mild winter. But it's always right there in the background. When you look you cast your glance outside and you see the trees are bare. They look like skeletons, right? A bare tree, a tree whose leaves have fallen off. It looks like a skeleton. Like it's been denuded of meat. And it's always at the back of your head, this death, this possibility that you're going to freeze to death and starve to death, especially for our ancestors who did not have food or heat security. And for them, winter was not a fun time. So I guess, what is the food tradition of European peoples? Have you been able to gather information on that, Huitgard?
Well, we tend to have the modern traditions of eating a goose or a turkey, and obviously turkey isn't very traditional. It's not native to Europe, but we do seem to have the tradition of the hog roast when wild boar and pigs were a lot more native to Europe. And interestingly, the point you made earlier about abundance. This seems to be one of the attributes that's particular for the god Yngfreyr or a Norse Yngvi Freyr, and he's the Lord Yng, but he's associated with nobility, but he's occasionally cited as being representative of abundance, not in terms of fertility, but just in the general production of abundance and increase. But he's also associated with the having a boar that's eaten called I think is their name translates as golden bristles, but. Frey
oh, I
has
remember been... it was an age of mythology.
Pardon?
Right, sorry, low IQ moment. Sorry. Okay. That's fascinating. Go on.
With the boar being sacred to Freya, it's very likely that the Germanic people had a tradition with eating the hog roast at Christmas. At Yule, and it does seem to be part of that element in terms of the increase of the new year. That eating this sacred hog or boar for on behalf of a feast of Yngvi Frey would bring about the increase of the new year. So it seems really to tie those two elements together. That's only the pagan Germanic tradition, but I can't say what was common for the rest of Europe. But it does seem that eating a large beast that could be shared within the community does seem to be the core tradition among that.
Indeed, I think that it's. It is a sort of defiance against winter and death that's going on over there. Of course, it has sacred elements because everything has sacred and religious elements. In the past, especially, and I think, you said the loss of community is the reason why we don't have wassailing and Christmas caroling and all of these things. all these traditions. And the fact that just so many people in our homelands are really no longer our people. You know, what does Karenling really mean to some Pakistani in England, right? What does the roast beast of Dr. Seuss fame, right? The roast goose mean to some Hindu, right? Don't they worship animals over there? It's one of those things. It's not just that the loss of community. I think it's a loss of religiousness, but more than a loss of religiousness, a loss of sense of awe about the world, because winter as a phenomenon is awe-inspiring. I mean, all the seasons are awe-inspiring, really. We are just seeing the last vestiges of fall here and the last golden leaves. When you cast a glance at the surrounding mountains here, right, you look out from the city into the mountains, and the way they transform into gold during autumn is amazing. Right. It's a beautiful sight. And it's gold and green and red, because some of the dry leaves, they turn red or orange. So many colors of fall. And then winter comes with the snow and the cold and the deep, you know, winter night where you can see the stars. And it's miraculous almost. You know, it is a great power. We fear it, but it is a great power. But the modern world has disenchanted so much of that. I don't think people even go into nature anymore. I go into nature when I hike, and I always find it a refreshing experience. Sometimes it's dangerous. I've been accosted by a wild boar several times, actually. I'm afraid to go hiking now because there's a bear loose near my hiking trails with a bear, a mama bear with cubs, and I've been missing it, you know. But when you are bracketed by such great powers as winter, as autumn, as, you know, mama bear with cubs, you have more wonderment with the world, and so your heart is more open to merriment. Take what joys you can have. Whereas we are so hyper-stimulated in this modern world. I don't think people can take joy in something as simple as a Christmas carol. I noticed that they're very easy songs to sing because they're meant to be sung by the entire population, not just by professional singers or someone who's really good at singing. Everyone needs to sing this, right?
Yeah.
It's something you do with your friends and your family and your neighbors to feel better, to experience communal joy, something we forget. And something which is unnatural to us when we observe it in others, right? I was thinking about this when I was seeing Western reactions to, you know, Croats celebrating the success of their football team. And Croatia is one of these countries which is still more or less cohesive, still has some vestige of cohesion, although things are pretty bad in Croatia as well with regard to all these problems. And you're thinking, oh, yeah, this is weird. They all look the same. They're all white. They're all jumping up and down. Like, people are celebrating a sports success. This is not weird. This was normal not 10 years ago in the West. No?
Yeah. Just something that's so natural and so normal has become pathologized and turned into a strange evil. Right. But, yeah, it's more important to have that sense of mystery, that sense of looking forward to the new year, not having any awareness of what's going to happen, but being able to have that sort of standing at the threshold, at the point of darkness of Christmas, and being able to look forward into that new year, to have your family around you, to honor your dead ancestors. And even Bede mentioned that Christmas Eve was originally called Modranicht, which is the Night of the Mothers, where it's very likely that the Disir, or the ladies, who were female spirits sort of presiding mother goddesses would be honored. So there's this core family element that's always stood there throughout pagan and Christian history of Christmas and Yule. It's that togetherness for those who are still with us, those who have who are now departed, and being able to feel that sense of unity, whether that's actual family or whether it's treating our sense of our race as our wider family, and having that sense of community. And that's the importance of Christmas, to be able to honour those who are with us, to share in that communal spirit.
It's the spirit of togetherness, because I find that of all the physical sensations, loneliness is most comparable to cold. Because when you are cold, you are lonely, and when you're lonely, you are cold. So in the dead of winter, when you have other people with you and you feel them in your soul, because that's the problem of the human being. We are all born alone, solipsistic. That is especially problematic with Western man, because we're just so much up here in our heads. We need something miraculous, something like Christmas, to feel other souls against our own. And that's really the meaning of Christmas, when you can feel a brother soul and not feel alone in the world and not feel cold. And we have a bunch of donations we need to read. People have been donating all evening. And before I get too sappy, before the spirit of Christmas overwhelms me or something. We have Michael57DE donating for $7.44. Now, that's a very specific number. With the matching grant, that will be $14.88. So, yeah, something to think about. He says, Heil Nix, Heil Heil Den Götten, which means Heil the Gods in German. No, hail the gods and hail Christmas. We have another $5 American from Michael57D, which will be matched by our generous donor, of course, to become $10. And he says, saw the other day about Rudolph, a very Jewish song. Outsider picked on because he was different. He has a red nose, but his nose was saved Christmas. Oh, yeah. With Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide? I mean, when you're not Jew aware, right, you think that Rudolph is a drunk. That's why his nose is red. But apparently, yeah, the nose being the defining physical difference between Rudolph and the other reindeer is really telling over there. Where did the reindeer come into the Santa myth? Are they traditional, or are they just an American invention from the Clement guy?
I think it is a invention by Clement. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be any earlier than that. But it is very interesting that Rudolph's nose seems to light and guide the way. It's almost like Rudolph imagines himself as being a light unto the nations. That's very curious.
Tikkun Olam over during the Yuletide, yes. He is illuminating the nations, illuminating the path for the arbiter of moral justice, which is, of course, Santa Claus. Rudolph, with your nose so fucking bright. so goddamn verse of that song. That whole concept. And reindeer, were they even in the European medieval psyche? I mean, I know they're not domesticated. The Sami live with them as nomads, and so do many Siberian tribes and Finno-Ugric tribes in what is today northern Russia. I don't know, did they even figure at any in any way among the Northern European or medieval European traditions, to your knowledge?
No, there's a brief mention of a reindeer in Anglo-Saxon stories, but talk about the ran, which is the same word as rein, which means clean. So a reindeer is a clean deer, but they don't seem to have any special meaning other than just being another form of animal. But when I was younger, when I'd write letters to Father Christmas, my family told me to address the letter to Lapland. So for us, he wasn't in the North Pole like the Americanized Santa Claus, but he seemed to live in Lapland. And I have no idea where this tradition came from. But it does seem to connect to the reindeer tradition, and then was probably back formed from that.
Right. I mean, I also heard about, I mean, I was also told about this. I think it's modern that Santa Claus, Father Christmas, Grandfather Frost, he lives in Lapland. And by tradition, I think that Finnish posts, and we have a bunch of Finns in chat, they can confirm or deny this. I think that the Finnish post delivers these to a post box office near Rovaniemi in I think that's Sami territory, which, I'm not sure. It's one of these, but it's one of these nice things, right? And there was a tweet recently by the United States Post Office that if your children write letters to Santa Claus, we'll be happy to shred them. And it made me think of that some time ago, like when the United States Post Office was maybe not anti-white or just anti-fun in general. They would have taken the letters and maybe pretended to mail them to Santa Claus, like in, you know, Miracle on 34th
34th Street.
Street, you know.
Oh, I just to say that I'm Miracle on 34th Street. But I
Right.
carry on.
Right. The film where they have the guy who thinks is, and it probably is, Santa Claus, right? Right, they would have delivered them to the local Santa Claus, or there would be a guy who is actually the local Santa Claus who dresses up as this Christmas spirit, as Father Christmas, to bring joy to the children. There was also in The Sopranos, right, after they whacked Big Pussy Bonpensiero, the community was so damaged that they couldn't find another guy to wear a Santa Claus suit and distribute gifts to the neighborhood children. And to think just how far this willingness to go to perform these Christmas rituals has fallen. 10, 20 years ago, I really doubt that the USPS, the United States Postal Service, would have bragged about shredding letters to Santa Claus. But we live in such a fallen, anti-white, anti-joy age that I'm not really surprised. I was disgusted. I was disturbed by that tweet, but I was not surprised. And that's really fun. That's really interesting. It's really funny. We have more donations. Let's talk about something, you know, more uplifting than children's letters to Santa Claus being shredded. We have ABC donating 20 American dollars over on Entropy, and he says, Orthodox Romania and Bulgaria were blocked from joining the Schengen zone by Catholic Austria and Netherlands. The justification was illegal immigration routes or buffer zone. Now Romania and Bulgaria have no motivation left to hold off the non-European invaders. Where is European unity? Merry Christmas, ho ho ho. Well, I'm not gonna say I know why Austria and Netherlands blocked Romania and Bulgaria, but I strongly doubt it's because Romania and Bulgaria are Orthodox. A fact of the matter is, and you know, Romanians and Bulgarians listening to this, you know, can confirm it. These two countries have a very significant gypsy population. I think that in Romania it could be 20% of the population. In Bulgaria, I've heard estimates as high as 25. You know, anyone has a better number, you know, correct me. And all of these people, they hold Romanian and Bulgarian citizenships. If Romania and Bulgaria are admitted into the Schengen area, it means that these gypsies will be free to travel through the entire Schengen area with no restrictions. They'll be eligible to work or even collect welfare in all of the Western European countries. And just and gypsies, they bring crime, they bring filth. And believe you me, Westerners, you don't know what filth is until you've met a gypsy and walked through a gypsy neighborhood. And they're not like the Irish travelers. They're nothing like the Irish travelers. You have to observe gypsies as they are in order to fully grasp the phenomenon. A whole package of filth, criminality, welfare abuse, and just block voting until they turn the country into a dysfunctional wreck. And that's, I believe, what's behind the Austro-Dutch decision to block Romania and Bulgaria. And I mean, it's tragic. It shouldn't be like that. We should have European unity. Romania and Bulgaria are white European countries. But the fact of the matter is, right, until, and of course, even if they try to get their gypsy problem under control, those same Western European countries would wag their fingers at them for being racist and not nice to the gypsies. So damned if you do, damned if you don't. That's a big problem. We need to address these questions, you know. Greg Johnson did a great show yesterday about how we can repatriate. Gypsies are, of course, they're an Indian population. They've been away from India for a very long time. But I think that if we took measures, you know, the countries of Eastern Europe, and work together with the government of India, we could repatriate them, maybe over a period of several generations, and they would assimilate into the general Indian population. But I think that joint projects of the governments of all of the countries which have gypsies, which are most of the countries of Southeastern Europe, Macedonia included, and the government of India, I think it could be done. I think it would be better for the gypsies. I think it would be definitely better for us. And I don't know if it would be better for India, but somehow we got to con them into doing it. Have you got any opinions on that, Whitgard?
Oh, yeah. I'm very familiar with gypsies. I've seen quite a few over time. But, they are indeed a problem. And But it's quite interesting that they do seem to have some awareness of demographics, and they're perfectly fine to import endless amounts of Africans, endless amounts of Arabs, but they clearly know the damage the gypsies can cause, and while they will gladly weaponize certain races for political ends, they daren't allow the free movement of gypsies. Probably because gypsies can't be controlled for political ends. So they have to be kept back. They can't just allow the free roaming of every non-white into Europe and around the Schengen zone. They know that if they did allow gypsies into Europe, they couldn't be controlled. They can't be used for political ends. So they know where to draw a line.
I mean, I wouldn't say they can't be controlled. The elites in Macedonia are pretty good at controlling them, actually, or the other way around. Maybe the gypsies control our political elites. It would certainly seem in some respects that gypsies have the upper hand because they block vote, and they're not a big part of, they're not a big percentage of Macedonia's population. I would say, maybe 5%, maybe 7%, I'm not sure. Certainly less compared with Bulgaria or Romania. But because they block vote, 7% in an election, that's a lot, right? It can swing a lot of elections. So I think what really it's because Europeans understand gypsies, but they don't understand Arabs and they don't understand blacks. When you mention a gypsy to a European, he immediately knows what's up. When you mention an Arab, he thinks of, and this was me for a very long time because I went to high school and because I went to a fancy schmancy American high school with a couple of highly intelligent Arabs from wealthy families. And yeah, these guys are like me, you know, they're high IQ, they're successful, they come from good families. So what, you know, they're countrymen. Could they be any worse? And yeah, they are much worse. When your sample size of Arabs or blacks are the talented 10th, right? You don't really have a clear picture of what these people are like. But I don't think there's any way you can fool any Europeans as to the nature of gypsies. So, yeah, that's good to know. And we have, I guess, reached, there are no more donations. Let me just refresh entropy. Yeah, no new donations. So I guess that's the end of the 2 hours. We have allotted to us. Quitgerd, would you care to give any closing words as to the topic of our conversation tonight?
Yes, there's a wonderful quote from Charles Dickens, who was very famous in bringing about the romanticization of Christmas into England. This is from Christmas Festivities, so I'll read these two small sections, which are very short. Christmas time, that man must be a misanthrope indeed, in whose breast something like a jovial feeling is not roused, in whose mind some pleasant associations are not awakened by the recurrence of Christmas. There are people who will tell you that Christmas is not to them what it used to be, that each succeeding Christmas has found some cherished hope or happy prospect of the year before dimmed or passed away, and that their presence only serves to remind them of reduced circumstances and straitened incomes, of the feasts they once bestowed on hallowed friends, and of the cold looks that meet them now in adversity and misfortune. Never heed such dismal reminiscences. Reflect upon your present blessings, of which every man has many, not on your past misfortunes, of which all men have some. Fill your glass again with a merry face and a contented heart. Our life on it, but your Christmas shall be merry and your new year a happy one. And I think that's a wonderful view of Christmas from Charles Dickens, that not only represents Christmas, but we as a people, and the same sort of positivity that we should see towards the future, not to only consider the past and dwell on the past and think that that we're living in a time of misery, because while times may be dire for us as European peoples, we should, as you said, fill our glass again and have a merry face and contented heart. And that's the attitude that we should have towards our people and to our future.
And here we are, as in golden days. Happy golden days of yore. Thank you for being my guest, Quitgerd. That's a very inspiring passage to close on. We will be exploring, of course, the problem of misanthropy and joylessness further still on this show and in our other activities in the future. But for tonight, I guess that's enough. We've been gabbing away for 2 hours. So I guess this has been a writer's block. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey, and tonight we discussed Christmas lore of the European nations with notable Anglo-Saxon scholar, historian, linguist, and folklorist Quitgerd, whom I'm also honored to call a friend. And I want to thank everyone. Oh, thanks.
Thank you, Nick.
I want to thank everyone who tuned in tonight. I want to thank everyone who's listening to the replay. We do this for you. We do this for your education, edification, so that you may become better fighters for our cause. But I also have selfish reasons, right? Because I want to win. I want white identitarian nationalism to win, and that means having the best white identitarian nationalists possible. That's the purpose of this show. I want to thank everyone who commented in the chat. I was following your comments. We have lively conversation. We are cultivating that elusive salon culture, which has been lost for so long. And I depend on this chat to conduct this show, because your input is what guarantees the high quality of these programs. I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank all of you because you're what makes the Countercurrents operation possible, this show possible. And remember, all of your donations will be doubled by our generous matching grant. And speaking of donations, right, we have one last minute donation, a diamond from Norse Nature, who says, thanks for the great show, guys. Well, thank you for your donation, Norse Nature, and for your attention, for your much coveted eyeballs and earlobes. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Gadius Maximus, Reed Johnson, and Bartleby, for keeping the chat safe and keeping everyone abreast of all of the relevant links. Guys, I don't know what I would do without you. And I want to thank you. I want to express my gratitude that you are performing all this labor for the cause and for the show. And with that, well, I guess this has been Writer's Block. Bye-bye, people, and take care.